unknown soldier. Another lesson learned. Kick the gas can over. Strike a match, get back and watch that sucker burn.
Thank you. White Aryan Resistance Radio calling. White Aryan Resistance Radio calling. This is Terrible Tommy, Tom Metzger, right here in the bunker right next to Terrible Tommy's Terrible Tavern Steakhouse and Filling Station. And that's right next to our Weapons of Mass Destruction giant used heavy equipment yard where we're getting ready to open up now. Boy, it's getting warmed up here. We got a whole new field full of heavy equipment, heavy armament, half tracks, you name it. It's all, we've been working on them all winter, and they'll be ready in the spring. You just get on down here and bring your semi down here and load them up and take them back to wherever, hide them in the caves, in the cornfields, or wherever. And you can use them when you see fit, because you'd be lone wolf. Yeah, we're P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. That's right. That's where you send your donations for the SHIEW and other projects we have. I just sent out some money orders to POWs today, and they're real happy to get them. I'll tell you that, because most guys have got pretty slim pickings inside the prison. And I know our one friend down there in Florida is in a real shit prison. Most of them are shit prisons, but the more Christian the area is, the worse they are. Do you notice that? Or do you know that? Well, it's true. I don't care what you believe. They believe they talk the New Testament, but act in the Old Testament way. Yeah, so these guys can use some funds once in a while. Incidentally, the one I'm talking about is in Florida. He's a creator, but whether they're creator or what they are, if they've served the program and meant well and are good boys, well, we try to help them out. Because you can be sure almost nobody in the old right-wing racist cause helps any of them out. Not that I know of. You know, yesterday I sent you out this expose by Covington, Harold Covington, by his brother. And I just happened to think about it. In 79, I think it was, they had a shootout in Greensboro with the Communist Workers' Party, where the Communist Workers' Party fired on the Klan and NS guys, and they shot back and killed two or three of the communists. And that dragged on for years. Luckily, most of them escaped, didn't get charged, but pretty much ruined their lives. There was one informant that was a painter, and I have his name here someplace, that was one snitch to the FBI, and Covington's handler in the case was a man by the name of Butkovich with the ATF. And he was his point man. It comes out in a trial, and the book is available someplace. It's Georgia, down in Georgia. Codename Green Kill is the name of the book. The 1979 Greensboro Killings. And anyhow, you'll see if, when it gets to trial in there, some interesting things about Harold Covington. And let's see, what else? Yes, after the criminal trial failed, the government, they didn't get anybody, there was a civil suit filed by the families of these Communist Workers' Party. And interestingly enough, Harold Covington, who was much probably the mastermind of the whole thing, never got sued at all, which is another indication that he was being taken care of by the feds. And that's just a little point that I happen to think of. And that book that I mentioned is available from Georgia University Press. It's a hardbound book. The author is Elizabeth Wheaton. Codename Greenkill, the 1979 Greensboro Killings. I'm not sure whether it's available cheap or not, but anyhow, you can check it out. I see another big long-ass magazine article has come out with all of this stuff about the terrorist right wing, the terrorist clan, the terrorist racists, and all that stuff, and goes on and on and on, have maps showing where they're all at and all these groups are at, everything. Sort of funny. And it's sad in a way, because the greatest terrorist in the United States and outside the United States is the United States government. There's no comparison. There's no any kind of comparison between the violence of the Klan and National Socialists and white Aryan resistance or anybody else than the government itself. But yet these people will spend hundreds of hours writing articles and books about how dangerous these groups are and these individuals are, when it's not the Klan that's dropping bombs all over the Middle East. It's not the Nazis. And it certainly is not white Aryan resistance. So it's ludicrous for these guys that write this shit to write about all this horrible violence, because there's almost nothing. Compare the violence, and many times it's self-defense violence, of any of these groups or individuals that happen to be white racist. Compare that to the crimes of the Republican Party, the membership of the Republican Party. It's full of people who've defrauded, killed, robbed, raped, serial killers, and everything else. Remember when John Gracie was his name, that killed all those kids up in Cleveland, I think. Now, he was not accused of being a racist. He was a Boy Scout leader. He had his picture taken with Jimmy Carter and Rosalind Carter, big supporters. So if you would ever take all the crime, the real crime of any of the political parties and other groups on the other side, there's absolutely no comparison. But yet they spend, I don't know, millions of dollars making a big deal out of the very small amount of crimes committed by white racialists. It's unbelievable. And it's the same. And the public looks at that, oh my God, it's horrible, they're coming to get us. Run for your lives. The same way that the United States government drone murders people all over the world, drops hundreds of thousands of tons of bombs, sells billions of equipment, war equipment, to other equally corrupt countries, and it goes on and on. And we're still cleaning up the mines that were left even in Vietnam. People are still having their legs and arms blown off from our government's involvement in Vietnam, where I think it was about 2 million people died. But that, you know, people gripe about it for a while, but then they say, oh, well, okay, look at George Bush. He's a war criminal, an absolute war criminal, the worst kind, being directed by Cheney, like the song I played in the beginning of the show. For these rotten, goddamn sons of bitches to point fingers at the racial movement or the right wing or even the left wing in this country, agonizing on and on about, oh, this guy killed one person. Oh, the roof's got to fall in. Now, whether it was a legitimate killing or not, it's only one killing or two or three compared to the millions that your Republican and Democrat-controlled government kills decades after decades. All Ronald Reagan and all the people he killed in Central America, lying to us that he was fighting communism Well, number one, it's that country's business. If a country wants to be communist, that's they can be communist. As long as they're not leaving their country and invading your country and doing something to you. But we all know now that it was a total narcotic scam. And it never stopped. The CIA and all its killing was being financed by narcotics and the cartels, just the way they're being financed now by the poppy fields of Afghanistan, with American soldiers out there cultivating the crops that's poured cheap heroin all over Europe and the United States. And these guys, these sons of bitches, have the gall to point fingers at a teeny tiny small percentage of people in this country that are white racial separatists, or even black racial separatists, or even Mexican separatists. I mean, the crimes committed in totality are nothing but a smidgen of what your government that taxes you to do all this killing. And yet people don't seem to see that. They don't seem to see that. And they'll scream and march around about a George Bush or a Clinton or whoever it may be that's committed all these crimes. I mean, you really brutal, bad, unhuman crimes against many people. And yet, they remember for a little while, but then they forget. Now they talk about lynching, but they don't tell the whole story. Now, a high percentage of the people that were lynched, no matter what color they were guilty of some pretty bad crime. Sure, there's some that weren't guilty, or they weren't, the crime wasn't that bad, but a large amount of them, they were lynched because they did something really bad. And actually, there's just almost as many white men were lynched during that same period of time. They always quote, I think, 1880 something to 1940 or something like that. Well, if you'll go to the Negro College, what's the name of it? I had it on the tip of my tongue, that famous Negro College. You'll find the paperwork in their library that shows that just a few more black men were lynched during the same period that white men were lynched. But they don't talk about that. They don't want to talk about that. Do you ever hear these sob sisters for the blacks ever saying, well, I read the circumstances of this fellow's crimes and it looks like he was guilty of rape and murder and mayhem and chopping up people and the whole bit. They never do that. They're always saying, like, well, 4,000 black men were lynched. So 4,000 black men were innocent because it happened during racial segregation or racial separation. Wait a minute. If they were justly lynched for doing heinous things, why would you be talking that way? It's a self-hatred. Our country's full of self-hatred. Whites have been taught to self-hate. Now, most of the people who have taught them to self-hate are white people. And there's a percentage, of course, of the Jews that do that because they get into the educational system, the college system. Pretty soon it becomes popular to say whitey's guilty of everything. He's always wrong. And if he ever lynched anybody, he's guilty because the guy obviously was totally innocent no matter what he did. Now they're going batshit over this these university students, sorority, or these students at Oklahoma University, over just singing a song with racist lyrics, not hurting anybody. But they had one sentence in there said something about hanging and lynching. So they're going absolutely crazy. They want them to be charged federally for singing that. But you've heard, and I've heard, a whole host of these black radicals preaching and saying all the time, kill all the white people, kill all the women, kill all the men, kill all the babies. Khalid Mohammed, you heard that, you know that. But that's, I guess, okay. Well, in a way, that's good for us because it's leading the percentage of white people to become more and more angry. The others, a lot of them are, you know, maybe a few million could be written off. But there's a percentage of whites that are finally, gradually beginning to understand what's going on. Finally. But it's going to take a while for an upheaval. Hell, it may take 20 years. But it's coming. And then it's going to be everybody for themselves or for your people. But they all know what Khalid Mohammed said. And they write it off and say, oh, that was just a deranged black man. They know what Malcolm X used to say and a lot of other these guys. And the guys that stood out in front of the polling place during the last presidential election saying, got to kill white people, got to kill them all, got to kill the men, women, and children. But these talk shows, they never play that back. And as far as I'm concerned, the right-wing conservatives are worse than the left-wing as far as their danger to the white race. They're worse. Now, the left-wing progressives keep attacking the conservatives. But these are not conservatives. What's conservative about them? Way I got into this politics, nobody I knew would have said spend $790 billion on armaments and occupy all these countries. If anything, they would have thought the Democrats would be proposing that kind of stuff. But I remember what a conservative was really like. And these are not conservatives. I guess they're properly named neocons. They got nothing to do with true conservatism. But it gives the progressives, who are misnamed progressives, and many of them are misnamed liberals because they're not liberal at all. They're sure not liberal about my free speech and my position before the law. They want to hang you. They want to make laws to outlaw speech. And they want to kill free speech. These demagogues on the right or the left that advocate that are just that, demagogues, and they hate free speech. I'm an absolutist on free speech. I believe everybody should have a total right to free speech, to say whatever they want to. And as long as it's not me standing up and telling 20 guys, now we're going to go down here and get a Molotov cocktails, we're going to go kill these people, it's totally protected. And in conspiracy charges, you've got to have three elements. One is the coming together of the minds. Two is making a plan. And then three, making a move towards completing your conspiracy. Just having a meeting of the minds that you don't like somebody, some group, or some philosophy doesn't make it a crime. But they're going to make it. They're going to get there because it's that way all over Europe. I think you're going to see a lot more violence if they ever get that pushed through. Having true freedom of speech doesn't breed violence. Only the suppression of free speech is what brings violence. Well, you see Nitwit one over there in Israel. My favorite term for him is Nitwit. And that's good because he's a crazy man. He's like George Bush Jr., a warmonger. And he's going to keep things going until Israel gets what it probably deserves. It's only going to be guys like him that are going to help it happen. With the backing of all the insane Christians here that support Israel no matter what they do. and supports Nitwick and Netanyahu, as his name, they'll support him no matter what he does. He can go out and kill tens of thousands of Palestinians or any Arabs or anybody else, and they support him. So looking at it in reverse psychology, that's good for us, because he'll overplay his cards like those kind of men always do. Ed Snowden, that is, come quickly, your country needs you. Once again, the American people are being victimized by a hush-hush blanket of official secrecy, rhetorical dodges, and outright lies. This time, it's not about wholesale spying on us by our government, but a wholesale assault on our jobs, environment, health, and even our people's sovereignty by a cabal of global corporations and the Obama administration. Their weapon is a scheme hidden inside the scam called TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. The scam is that the TPP is nothing but another free trade deal, about a whopper of a deal that ties our economy to Brunei, Vietnam, and 9 other nations around the Pacific Rim. But of the 29 chapters in this deal, only 5 are about tariffs. The real deal is in the 24 other chapters that create a supranational scheme of exclusive, unelected, secretive tribunals that corporations from any TPP nation can use to challenge and overturn our local, state, and national laws. All corporate power has to do to win in these closed tribunal proceedings is to show that one of our laws or regulations might reduce its future profits. This is big stuff, amounting to the enthronement of a global corporate oligarchy over us. Yet it has been negotiated among the trade officials of the 12 countries in strict secrecy. Even members of Congress have been shut out, but some 600 corporate executives have been allowed inside to shape the partnership. Now that Obama and his corporate team are ready to spring it on us and ram it through Congress, he arranged a briefing to woo House Democrats. But he classified it as a secret session, meaning the lawmakers can't tell the people anything they learn. A gag order on Congress? Holy Thomas Paine. The only reason Obama is desperate to hide his oligarchic scheme is because the people would overwhelmingly oppose it. So he's resorted to government by sucker punch. It's cowardly, and it's disgraceful, and it's treasonous.
Behind high walls with guarded gates. Rich people tend to live behind high walls with guarded gates. Then there are the uber-rich. They don't need walls and gates, for they isolate themselves from us riffraff the natural way, by buying their very own private islands. But holding the masses at bay is not the real reason that the swells lay out up to $30 million for these watery enclaves. Rather, says one luxury real estate expert, it's the ultimate I've arrived statement. Yes, but I would add that it's also a way for an overachieving super richie to shout out to other richies, "See? Mine's bigger than yours." These days, there's been a surge in sales of private islands thanks to the convergence of 2 economic forces. First came rising inequality, with the privileged few at the top taking ever more of the world's wealth. Second, according to a luxury property firm with a perfect name of Candy and Candy, prices for quality islands fell during the global financial collapse. Thus, a $50 million 43-acre island in the Lesser Antilles, with a plantation house, 2 cottages, a protected bay for your yacht, and a landing pad for your helicopter, can now be had for only half that. Before you grab your checkbook to purchase such a bargain, however, note that the price tag is hardly the total tab. Annual upkeep on your paradise can easily run $300,000. All that for a getaway you might only get away to for a few weeks a year. Yet, with the income gap continuing to widen into a chasm, the number of those with the money to splurge on such ego-boosting baubles is expected to grow from 200,000 to about 250,000 in the next 2 years. This is Jim Hightower saying, instead of frittering away so much and so few, what say we find one isolated tropical island, build a big fence around it, and make all of these narcissistic egos live there with each other?
And there's always the other way, too. There's a lot of surplus military amphibious equipment around, and it wouldn't take too many men to take an island, even with the best of their security. That time will come, too. Maybe. We'll see. So start finding out where they're at and picking one out for yourself. And when the time is right, you can go shopping. Or should I call it expropriation? TT, I like this series. I started watching it a few years ago when I was in college, and I've been going back watching all the episodes I missed. It is not pro-white in any way I would like to see. However, it does have some good racial themes in it. The character Merle could have been based on Tom Metzger. He only appeared in a few episodes, but I thought the way he represented a racial character was not too bad. He never capitulated. It is a zombie horror drama, but most of it is about the way characters change with their struggle. I think the writers did a good job showing that. Well, I guess that's you can find that at HTTP and then, you know, wikipedia.org/wiki/Merle_Dixon. But the person who sent this to me, I don't think told. Oh, yeah. Wait a minute. I don't know. Anyhow, I'll have him send it to me. I'm not sure whether it's from The Walking Dead. No, that's too new for The Walking Dead. Okay. Oh, yeah, I remember Merle. I went over here to Wikipedia, and it has it up here. Yeah, I remember Merle. He was cool. Merle Dixon, a fictional character from the horror drama television series The Walking Dead, which airs on AMC in the United States and is based on the comic book series of the same name. He was created by series developer Frank Darabont and portrayed Michael Rooker. The character was first introduced in the first season as a southern redneck hunter who has a younger brother, Daryl. He's misogynistic and racist. That's the kind I like, which causes tensions between him and his group of survivors. Following an encounter with the series protagonist Rick Grimes, Merle disappears and joins the community of Woodbury, Georgia, where he becomes the right-hand man of the governor. He becomes caught in a conflict between the governor and Rick, especially when nobody in Rick's group wants him in the group, except for Daryl. Yeah, I like that. Thanks for sending that to me. See, one of the attributes of a racist or a healthy racist is that he doesn't trust many people. He's always watching behind him, seeing who's creeping up on him. He tends to be cynical, which I am. I think I have a much more a better sense of humor than Merle, but otherwise, I think it fits. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, here it says, the character's introduction garnered negative reviews from professional race-mixing critics. Jews, Negroes, and white liberals. But fan response was positive. When the character reappears in a third season, reviewers began to have more favorable views towards him. Merle is an original character in the television series and shares no counterpart in the graphic novels. He is also a main character in the 2013 video game The Walking Dead Survival Instinct, which focuses on him and Daryl during the early days of the zombie apocalypse. Well, you can go up there to Wikipedia and read the rest. Merle Dixon. Okay, Merle. This fellow, Michael Rooker, has played quite a bit of roles. He's been around Hollywood for quite a while. I've seen him in a lot of movies and TV series. And they usually cast him as a badass bad guy. But to me, many people they cast as bad guys are who I like as good guys. It's because some Jew producer, some race mixing guy in Hollywood wants you to think one way. You don't have to think that way. I go to the movies and I decide who's the hero. I don't let them decide who's the hero. I decide who's going to be my hero, so fuck them. I mean, sorry. And now it's coming back to me about Merle and that Walking Dead. They went into Atlanta for some reason, and they had an internal fight. Merle did something they didn't like, and they chained him up on top of a building and left him. And I remember that part. And he eventually got loose. But I believe that's his young brother that's still alive in the show and still working at it. And he's just a hell of a lot like Merle. Now they're into this too-good-to-be-true town that they've run into. It's got a wall around it. Everybody's living a regular lifestyle like nothing happened. Beautiful homes, everything. But just like Merle and the boys, I'm suspicious. Something wrong with this. This ain't right, man. Well, on Sunday, the neocon Washington Post allowed this guy by the name of Murachek to use its opinion section to advocate an aggressive war against Iran. These goddamn war lovers. Essentially, a perpetual U.S. bombing campaign against the country. Despite the fact that aggressive war is a violation of international law, condemned by the post-war World War II Nuremberg Tribunal as the supreme international crime. Well, you see, it applied to Germany, but nobody else. Nobody's been tried under Nuremberg statutes since World War II. And remember, government, our assholes, our criminals in government, were the ones that financed the overthrow of Medeljevic, I think his name was, in Iran, who was a democratically elected leader and put that damn Shah in charge. It's no wonder the Iranians would hate us. In fact, it's no wonder that everybody in the Middle East hates us except Israel, and they hate us because they're jealous of us. We got more money than they do, or we've got more debt than they do. Given that the Post is very restrictive in the op-ed pieces that it prints, it is revealing that advocacy of unprovoked bombing campaign against Iran is considered within the realm of acceptable opinion. You see, I only advocate racial separation. But that's the mortal sin, the mortal crime. Here's a guy that wants to bomb millions of people into the Stone Age. We need to deserve and listen to his opinion. But the truth is that the only difference between Muravchik's view and the Post's own editorial stance is that Muravchik lays out almost certain consequences of sabotaging a diplomatic solution. Diplomatic solution normally means peace. In his article headlined "War is the only a step away, is only a way to stop Iran," in print editions, and the war with Iran is probably our best option. Of course, he won't be fighting it. None of these guys will be fighting it. Probably none of their kids will be fighting it. Let's do it this way. If you want to have a war with Iran, you institute the draft. You don't want any war with Iran? If you institute the draft, there'll never be a war with Iran or anybody else. You can imagine trying to draft these young people in this country today. Are you kidding? Muravchik lets the bloodthirsty neocon cat out of the bag as he agrees with the Israeli prime minister Benjamin Nitwit, hysterically view of Iran, but recognizes that killing international negotiations on limiting Iran's nuclear program would leave open only one realistic option, Dr. Strangelove. Incidentally, I watched that film again about a week ago. It still holds up, man. Dr. Strangelove. Quote, what if force is the only way to block Iran from gaining nuclear weapons? Well, here's the way you do that. You say, will you agree not to build a nuclear weapon if Israel gets rid of its nuclear weapons? Simple. No problem. That, in fact, is probably the reality. Sanctions may have induced Iran to enter negotiations, but they have not persuaded it to abandon its quest for nuclear weapons, nor would the stiffer sanctions that Netanyahu nitwit advocates bring a different result. Well, wouldn't you want a nuclear weapon with Israel with 200, over 200, and all those other countries, Pakistan, India, all the rest of them, you know, got nuclear weapons? Why is Iran so different? Quote, does this mean that our only option is war? Yes, although on an air campaign targeting Iran's nuclear infrastructure would entail less need for boots on the ground. That's a sick term, boots on the ground. Men on the ground is what should be. Than the war Obama is staging against the Islamic State, which poses far smaller threat than Iran does. Wouldn't destroying much of Iran's nuclear infrastructure merely delay its progress? Perhaps we can strike as often as necessary. Well, it's working out that the United States will have nobody in the world that respects it, only fear it. But you can't hold everybody just in fear forever. Typical of the neocon bastards like Cheney and those guys, Muravchik foresees no problem with his endless bombing war against Iran, including the possibility that Iran, which Western intelligence agencies agree is not working on a bomb, might reverse its course if faced with repeated bombing assaults from the United States. And probably then Israel would get involved too. Yeah. Nice people that run our country. Have you ever been asked, polled by anybody about how you think about this? Whether you want to go to war? Do you want to go to war, Mr. and Mrs. America? Most people are going to say no. Oh, yeah, but to save Israel and pave the way for the baby Jesus to come back. Would you agree to that? Well, a lot of the all these millions of fundamentalists probably would. But the more rational element would not. Oh, they're going to attack us. Iran's going to attack us any minute. Then would you vote for it? Well, maybe, but I don't see how they're going to be able to attack us. This neocon advocated violation of international law also might further undermine hopes of curbing violence in the Middle East and the establishing of a form of meaningful order there and elsewhere. This neocon view that America can do whatever it wants to whomever it wants might actually push the rest of the world into a coalition against the U.S., bullying that could provoke an existential escalation of violence with nuclear weapons coming into play. I don't know. Maybe there is a death wish. Maybe there's a death wish. Just keep pushing everybody. United States, the War Department, all these people, just keep pushing people, pushing people, pushing people, occupying people, furnishing arms for killing millions of people. There's got to be a pushback coming. There's going to be a pushback coming. And don't expect me to fight for those bastards. Even though I'm pretty physically fit, I wouldn't. And I would do everything in my power to dissuade, whether you're black or white or Mexican or what, not to support the system. Yes, that's what I would say. Well, there's more to this, but you get the idea. There's a certain element of taking over in our military-industrial complex and the high command of this country. And the financial corporations, predatory capitalists, want ongoing war forever. They figure that's the only way they can make any money. I guess. Well, let me close out today with a little bit of reading from A Man Called Lucy that we've been working on for a while. The most important spy of World War II, most effective spy. And we covered the fact that he furnished in his spy cell, furnished all the information that the countries of France, Belgium, Holland, all those could have thwarted the invasion through their property by the German forces. But they didn't accept his information, didn't believe it. And so they found out the hard way. And then the next thing, he tries to give this information from the OKW, German intelligence, and his 10 people working with him in the high command, right from the chancellery, to the Russians, and they thought he was a spy against them. And so he was told that if he wanted them to listen to him, he'd have to charge them money. So once he became a hired gun, they started believing him. So anyhow, we were reading before where Hitler finally made his move on Barbarossa, invading Russia. And like I said, Stalin was totally, he didn't know what to think. He was out of it for 10 days because he actually trusted Hitler, according to everything I've been able to get out. With hardly time for a breathing space, Hans Guderian now moved northwards with his tanks, a month and a half after the original rendezvous with Eremenko. He arrived at Bryansk. Guderian took the Soviet armies from behind and forced open their lines. Like Kiev, Bryansk fell, then Yasma, the Wehrmacht, now moved straight on to the Soviet capital. They were to get no farther than the city's outlying suburbs when they were halted, exhausted, and already handicapped by the approaching winter, a winter for which they had no preparations. The Germans did not yet know that this was to cost them the war. Yeah, they had no winter clothing. And if it wasn't for... Joseph Goebbels, they wouldn't have had any. Hitler wasn't taking care of it. Goebbels went barnstorming all over Germany to get people to contribute their fur coats, especially the women, of course, their fur coats and all kinds of winter clothing to get immediately as fast as possible up to the front. If he hadn't pulled that off, those people, they all would have froze to death. However, their confidence was somewhat shaken by what their military security service had discovered in the middle of October among the ruins of Bryansk. More documents which explained Eremenko's inertia as Guderian's troops had moved almost under his nose. The Russian general had been expecting an attack on positions he knew to be impregnable if attacked head-on. These documents were a copy of Plan 1, as revised by Halder and presented to Hitler on August 18th at Rastenburg. Military security then decided to hand over the results of these extraordinary discoveries to the Abwehr, the Wehrmacht's official organization for espionage and counter-espionage. But since its head, Admiral Canaris, was already suspected of betraying the cause of the Führer, the SD, then directed Reinhard Heydrich, was also informed. Now that, I believe that group was the, Anwar was in charge of U.S. intelligence, and it was piss poor, terrible, I mean, almost nothing. And here, Germany had declared war on the United States, and they didn't have hardly any spies inside the United States. Heydrich at once recognized the whole affair's vital importance. Like Hitler, he had always detested the German officer corps, unable to forget that his career in the Navy had ended in discharge for gambling debts and dishonorable actions. He was convinced that among the band of officers in whose hands the salvation of Germany rested, there was a traitor, or perhaps several, who were acting as Soviet informers. The exceptional nature of these discoveries made by military security on the Eastern Front confirmed his suspicions. He would have to discover who they were at once. Well, it turned out he was very slow at finding out, Heydrich, and he certainly didn't find out before he was killed. Heydrich would have liked to have taken over the job personally, but hadn't the time. He was too preoccupied with party intrigues, so he decided to entrust the inquiry to his brilliant assistant, young SS Brigadfuhrer Walter Schellenberg. Walter Schellenberg was a real smart, genius guy. And you can read about him in other places. He was really good. And he was within 2 weeks of breaking that 10-man spy cell in Berlin. Schellenberg was a Nazi intellectual who talked brilliantly of music, literature, and painting. He claimed to despise politics, yet at 32, he was the youngest of the Nazi leaders, the man whom Himmler affectionately called his Dauphin. Born in Dessau in 1910, the youngest of seven children, Schellenberg was old enough to remember the horrors of the First World War. His father was a piano maker, not a very prosperous trade back in 23, when an exhausted, impoverished Germany thought more of appeasing its hunger pangs than amusing itself. So the family immigrated to Luxembourg. I've been in Luxembourg many times when I was in the army in Germany in peacetime. It's a nice place. In the summer of 1929, Walter went to Bonn University. For 2 years, he studied medicine, then took up law. The world crises and the desperate economic situation in Germany, exacerbated by the degenerate political atmosphere of the Weimar Republic, did not leave the Schellenbergs unaffected. Let's see here. I've got a little, picking up a little noise here. Oh, where was I at? Walter was forced to ask for a scholarship to complete his studies. The judge who dealt with his case hinted that he would have a better chance of obtaining aid if he joined the Nazi Party and the SS organization. Suddenly, everything appeared to be quite simple. In 1934, Schellenberg gave a lecture on the development of German law, in the course of which he attacked the Catholic Church. This drew Heydrich's attention, and two of his advisors, both professors at Bonn University, approached Schellenberg and engaged him. His future looked bright indeed, but he owed his extraordinary success to his own gifts and to hard work, not to favoritism, so rampant in Germany since the Nazis had come to power. If Himmler had taken him into his confidence, it was because of his ability as a jurist, because of his sound knowledge of Western Europe. Himmler had even ordered his own doctor, a Finn called Karsten, who was utterly devoted to him, to take particular care of Schellenberg's health. He suffered from a bad liver. Now, if they had taken this Schellenberg on earlier and put him at the head of the intelligence division, I think things would have turned out a lot differently. Not that he could have won the war, but he was really, really a Sam Spade of the day, a Sherlock Holmes of the day. He was also on a very close terms with Admiral Canaris. Well, he found out later Canaris was a traitor, and they hung him, Canaris, by piano wire. Unfortunately, it was Canaris that was the head of ANWR, that had to do with American intelligence and sabotage and so forth in the United States. And so, yeah, he was a real bad guy on the other side. Every morning when they were both in Berlin, they went riding together. In the open air, they were able to exchange confidential information without danger of eavesdropping. The head of the ABWAR was something less than careful in his choice of assistants. He tended to swell the ranks of his organization somewhat indiscriminately, so much so that since early 1941, one of Schellenberg's tasks had been the liquidation of certain unreliable elements of the ABWAR. Of all Hitler's generals, Schellenberg was the most widely traveled, but he had never left his headquarters in Beckerstrasse, in Berlin, Smorgendorf, without good reason. It was from there that he ran the F bureaus of the SD, that is, all of his espionage networks throughout the world. But again, too much too late. The British MI5 or MI whatever, in the beginning, they were so far ahead of the Germans, it was unbelievable. I mean, a lot of times people don't think of the British as being quite as sharp as they are, but their intelligence service was tremendous, still is. Contrary to the portrait of himself that Schellenberg presented to the British after the fall of the Third Reich, that of a cultured man of Western, not to say Latin tastes, and which many believed to be true, I was never able to see him anything other than a faithful copy, a perfect reflection of Reinhard Heydrich, even to the bearing of the head, the smile, the presence, and the passion of horsemanship. Unfortunately, he was had also the same cold cruelty, the same profound amorality, and the same aristocratic art of concealing his vices. Heydrich was his intellectual master. Well, I don't know how much of that I'd believe, but anyhow. This astonishing portrait was provided by Hans Bernd Gavelius, wartime German vice consul in Switzerland, and one of the organizers of the attempt on Hitler's life on July 20, 1944. It explains the extraordinary similarity between the actions of the two men. In fact, three of Schellenberg's early masterful schemes, the framing of two British agents at Venlo, Holland, the manufacture of false pound notes at Orenburg, and the manipulation of the spy Cicero, all bore the unmistakable imprint of Heydrich. The Venlo affair had begun on the evening of November 8, 1939, in a restaurant in Munich, where every year Hitler celebrated the anniversary of his failed push in 23. Suddenly, Hitler had broken off his speech and fled from the table just before a bomb clumsily concealed in a pillar exploded. He was to recount later how a voice within had urged him to leave. But everything had led political and technical observers to believe that the entire assassination attempt was prearranged by the Nazis themselves in an attempt to increase the Führer's popularity, which is totally possible. In the early hours of the morning of November 9th, Walter Schellenberg went into action. At Venlo in Holland, very close to the German frontier, he led a group of SS that arrested two British officers, Captain S. Payne Best and Major R.H. Stevens, agents of the British Intelligence Service. Since October 21, 1939, he had suspected the pair of working for a group of German generals who wished to overthrow Hitler and set up a new regime with the blessing of Great Britain. In fact, he was holding them in readiness for the right moment. Captain Best and Major Stevens, accused of having organized the Munich plot from Venlo, were to spend the rest of the war in a concentration camp. This accusation was also served shortly afterwards as a pretext for Germany's invasion of Holland, such an attack being justified on the grounds that this country has abused the privileges of neutrality by harboring two such violent enemies of the Third Reich. Hitler was so delighted by the success of this ruse that he gave Schellenberg the job of devising and carrying out himself a plan to kidnap the Duke and Duchess of Windsor. The Führer was irrational enough to believe that in this way he might persuade the ex-King of England to collaborate with him and arrange a peace with Britain. At the end of July 1940, the royal couple were in Lisbon. They were to be abducted and given residence in Germany, as well as some $160,000 already placed in a bank in Geneva, which would be put at their disposal. If necessary, Hitler would increase the amount. The kidnapping failed by a hair's breadth when agents of the British Intelligence Service arrived in Portugal one day before the young SS general. Schellenberg's counterfeiting scheme, known as the Bernhard Operation, involved the production of huge quantities of forged silver banknotes. These were to be poured into the coffers of the banks of neutral countries, diminishing real British currency in value. Inventive as he was in such matters, this plan was not altogether his own. It had been conceived in November 39 by a certain Alfred Helmut Najax. Schellenberg had been quite fond of Najax, had enlisted his aid in kidnapping of Best and Stevens at Venlo, and it was Najax who had justified the invasion of Poland by the Wehrmacht by carrying out a mock attack on the German radio station at Gilowitz on the night of August 31st, 39, with other SS men disguised like himself as Polish soldiers. Schellenberg made various improvements on the Najax rather crude plan. The paper needed for the false notes were extremely difficult to imitate. It had to be made from pure linen, without cellulose, soiled, then washed in detergents. It was prepared in the Spechthausen factory in Eberswalde near Berlin. Engraving the plates and printing the notes was carried out under the direction of Captain Kruger in a secret hideout, an anonymous shed in the concentration camp at Orenburg. The forgery was perfect. Toward the end of 41, one of Schellenberg's agents changed a large quantity of 5-pound and 10-pound notes in Switzerland. He even dared ask that they be verified, saying that he had bought them from the black market. The Bank of England kept only 10% of them as suspect and recognized the rest as perfectly genuine. Schellenberg had them proceed to put the false notes into circulation in Switzerland, though a certain Dr. Willy Grobel, and in Genoa and Trieste, through an engineer called Friedrich Schwarz, even when these two cities were no longer under the control of the German army, the trafficking continued till the end of the war. The third scheme was an espionage affair which was to become famous after the war as the Cicero Affair. SS Sturmbannerfuhrer Ludwig Moisi, who was in charge of the SD mission in Ankara, the Turkish capital, informed his chief that he had become very friendly with a certain Alexia Bosna. Bosna, an Albanian, was the valet to the British ambassador, Sir Hugh Knatchbull Hugesson. This connection promised a rich harvest. Schellenberg urged them to pursue the contact, But how was Bosna, who was proving very greedy, to be paid? Schellenberg hardly hesitated. He would use the wonderful forged currencies made at Orenburg. In fact, and these typical Machiavellian operations indicate, Reinhard Heydrich and Walter Schellenberg complemented each other so perfectly that one had only to throw out a vague idea for the other to carry it out beyond all hopes of its originator. Thus, when one evening Heydrich happened to say that the SD ought to set up an establishment in which foreign visitors could come and amuse themselves in agreeable company and where involuntarily they would give away valuable information, Schellenberg began the next day to plan the famous Kitty Salon. The prettiest German prostitutes as well as ladies of the highest social standing attended its extremely informal gatherings and performed a variety of veritable military service. Many a diplomat lost his self-control in this paradise, filled with invisible microphones, tape recorders, and cameras. Following indiscreet revelations made this a deluxe brothel, situated in the heart of the fashionable district quarter of Berlin of the period. Count Galeazzo Ciano, Mussolini's son-in-law, lost his life. It was also why, as soon as Heydrich gave him the job of unmasking the traitors who had passed information to the Russians, Schellenberg conceived a scheme that was entirely typical of his instigator. Toward the end of October 41, he drew up a plan of action. He would not attempt to go through the entire officer corps with a fine-tooth comb to find the traitors, at least not immediately. There were no fewer than 3,000 generals and 320,000 officers of other ranks in the Wehrmacht. Instead, he would concentrate his attention on the weak spot that sooner or later gave most subversive networks away, radio communication. In fact, it was the unmasking of another spy ring, De Rote-Capelle, a network that had been working for the Russians and had distributed a large number of agents throughout Western Europe, that persuaded Schellenberg to begin the communications. The SD had first intercepted, then decoded its messages. Since then, most of the operators had been arrested by means of radio goniometry. That's where they go around with a loop antenna on the roof of vans, and they can zero in their directional antennas. I've got one here, in the act of transmitting their wireless telegrams. It was a simple matter to make these operators denounce their accomplices. One after another, the agents of De Rote-Capelle, which had certainly paid little attention to secrecy measures, fell into the nets of the SD. Radio goniometry was as disastrous an invention for secret agents as radio telegraphy had been for the countries on whom they were spying. It was this technique that helped Colonel Ozaki, the head of Japanese counter-espionage, to capture the famous Richard George. A gonio set is a simple receiver in which a mobile frame pivoting on an axis replaces the usual aerial. Experience and calculation had shown that reception of a broadcast was always stronger when the frame was directed straight at the transmitting station. Now, we used to do this in ham radio years ago, I think in the, way back when I was in high school. We had hidden transmitter hunts, and we would... there would be a transmitter hidden someplace in the geographical area, maybe a county or part of a county. And then all these people, there'd be usually two men to a car, and they would have their loop antennas on the top, and they would chase down this hidden transmitter. And the winner would get a prize. And so I was quite... experienced in that type of activity, so I know exactly what they're talking about. You see, probably in these old World War II movies, you'll see once in a while a van going down the street with this circular antenna revolving around looking for a radio transmission. Yeah. The position of the frame, therefore indicating the geographical line on which the target station. Another thing, too, we have these loop deals, you can buy them commercially, that if you're living in an area where you want to hear something on AM radio, some of you, you know, bugs your way out there and you can't seem to pick it up, it's weak, and you set this loop antenna behind your radio, and it has a knob to tune it, and you can tune a station and bring a station that's very weak up till it's very, very good, and you can hear quite well. So if you know anybody that's got that problem, they sell these loop antennas on the market. I think that that outfit that sells stuff through Coast to Coast Radio has them. I think they're about $50. But if you got a horrible FM or AM, not FM, AM radio problem, that's the thing to get. One had only to follow this line in order to lay hands on its operators. A genio set could also be used in another way by orienting it so that the reception became minimal or disappeared altogether. The perpendicular to the frame then gave the required direction. Tripled and operating from three different points, the genios were able to indicate the precise position of an illegal transmitter. It was never long before its operators were seized. That's why any kind of communications like that has to be mobile, has to be moving all the time. If you if you're trying to communicate and you want to remain secret, And probably your best method of doing it is by using Morse code. But you got to keep on the move, because if you set up in one spot, you don't have a chance. They're going to get you. One major motive urged Schellenberg to take an interest in the problem of broadcast in order to find the traitors that Heydrich sought. He knew that radio alone could be used to pass information to the Russians. It was virtually impossible to imagine a messenger service crossing the Wehrmacht's lines bearing documents for the Russians. Well, I think that's got to be about it for today. I see I'm over time here. And let me put this on pause, and we're going to get out of here. Now, a lot of people would poo-poo all this, but with the satellites and everything like that, and satellites is fine, and they do a great job, but what happens if the satellites go dead, or the Russian or the American government turns them off, or whatever could happen? You're going to have to go back to low-tech. So you can pick up all these in used bookstores, amateur radio manuals, and all this kind of stuff that you can buy for 10 cents, a quarter maybe, and keep a little library of low-tech information so that in a situation you can build your own transmitter. It may not be the greatest, but I had a 10-watt transmitter I used to talk to South Africa with when I was in high school, so it don't take a lot of power if you're under the right conditions. And don't discount even the old CB, and also merchant, radios for boats. Radio. I got a brain fart. Radios for boats are cheap. They run around. They'll put out about 25 watts, and usually there's not many people, especially all through the Midwest, that are in boats. So things like that can do you. Now's the time to put that stuff, buy it at garage sales and put it away. Go to these ham radio auctions and buy the stuff and seal it up and keep the moisture out of it and put it away. And that's it for today. We'll be back tomorrow on Wotan's Day, David Lane's favorite day, 14-5.